This is the Mark Boris Podcast.
Great morning. It's been a beautiful morning. I had a fantastic Easter break. I went up to my farm and hung out up there and, watched the cows roam around the place, and I talked to my staff, and looking forward to today's podcast. We've got Guillaume Brahimi here.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, mate, a great mate of mine, and Nick Boris. Good morning, Nicko. Hey,
good morning, guys. Nick, thanks for coming in, Guillaume.
Nick, pleasure. Well, speaking of great chefs, Nick Boris went down to Bannister's and had dinner with Rick Stein, and we've got Guillaume Brahimi. Mate, Nick, you have to cook something big tonight, mate.
No pressure.
I'm a big fan of both of these guys, actually. And I said that to Rick when he sat down. I said, I didn't want to go up and hassle him, but I did say, look, I thought I should mention I am a fan. When your shows come on about, India and the subcontinent and Southeast Asia, I'm always sort of watching them. And it's good. It's a different kind. He was quite a funny bloke. It's a different kind of fan base. He often gets sort of, 40, 50 plus women coming up to him asking him to sign their breasts on occasion.
You serious?
Guillaume,
has that ever happened to you?
I think they've had.
Has any woman ever asked you to sign her breasts?
They go to his events.
Not yet.
They get sourced up usually before he arrives. Time he gets there, they're all sort of half cut, and the older girls, they sort of walk over and it's interesting because he's their rock star. You know what I mean? The ladies that are sitting at home, with lifestyle food on, watching his stuff. He's the everything for them. So
it's funny how food it's funny how food, like 15 years ago, you wouldn't watch a food show. Maybe you did. We used to have that guest, there's a French guy,
Gabriel Gatti.
He's still around. But that was sort of about as much you ever got. But now we have food channels, and food's such an important part of life. I mean, what's brought all this about?
I think the social media, big part of it, which business you can be reviewed on the spot and be sure around the world, every night in my restaurant I will have somebody doing a review live on TripAdvisor, on all these websites. So that's everybody's a foodie now. All these reality TV shows. I think there's two variety of show who help a lot my industry. Firstly, there's the Rick Stein shows, all about showing the great world we live in.
Sure.
Food Safari, there's no competition. It's about actually admiring and, seeing all these people from the baker to the butcher to the grower. So showing the great country we live in and also the rest of the world. And after that, you've got the reality TV was a contest.
Mm. Everybody wants to be on MKR.
MasterChef, Hot Plate. And
I love MKR.
They're great. Yeah. But, I've been on these shows, so I can't say they're bad because they're huge amount of followers. But we need to cross. There is a line, and a chef, being a chef is much more than just being on a reality TV show.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. I started cooking 33 years ago, and when I started cooking, reality being a chef was not a very fashionable thing.
And well, tell us about it.
I come from a family of doctors and a chef. Mum, very good cook. Dad wouldn't be able to cook an egg. but just to understand, I come from France. France got a
rich history.
Well, I jump around, but I remember arriving in Australia and going to find bread, and the only bread I could find was a bread slice with an expiry date. That's an expiry date. My grandmother, till the day she died, and she died in 98, was going to get bread for the breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner. For herself, she was eating by herself. She used to have a quarter of a baguette at each time. Yeah. And that's the way 80% of the French people do. My dad will go buy the cheese. That's his job on a Saturday. He goes to the market. He will go buy a wash wine in a 6 arrondissement, but he knows the best blue is in a 12 arrondissement. So he will spend 2 hours to go buy. And he's not a cook.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the way we live. Yeah. So when I say I wanted to be a cook, firstly, I was very lucky because I was 14 and I knew what I wanted to do. huge relief for my parents. I was never going to be a Rhodes Scholar. And
what about a rugby player, weren't you?
Oh, I wish I was.
Finding a career in rugby?
I wish I was, but we used to get paid a case of VB when I was playing, so I would. No, but I love cooking. I love the restaurant industry. Actually, it's a whole concept I love. I love making people happy. Mm. That's what the hospitality is about. You know, you can call celebrity chef, whatever, but at the end of the day, my joy is when I see my restaurant full of happy face. And seeing the empty plate. I know it sounds cliche, but seeing a plate who's been not leak, but use a bread to finish the sauce, for me, I've done my job. So I've got a pretty, no, but you know I what I mean? That. So I've got a pretty easy job, you know, like we're not saving the world, but we make people happy. And that's really important.
So you're saying though, do you think that's important though, Guillaume, to be successful? Because everyone in this world is all about success. You say successfulness is actually the outcome, that is you appreciating somebody else's wiping the plate with the bread. Is that what success is about, making lots of money?
No, so that's my happiness.
Yeah.
And my happiness is based on that, of making people happy and seeing my restaurant full and seeing my plate empty. But what makes me happy also is I've got about 140 staff. So all of his 140 staff, some of them pay school fees, some of them pay education, some of them pay rent, some of them pay mortgage. So I believe I am part of the Australian economy. You know, I contribute a big part of it. But being successful financially, well, I have to be successful financially, so I need to make the business work, because if it doesn't work, if it doesn't make money, at the end of the day, it's a business. And if a business doesn't make money, you need to close it very quickly.
Sure. Mm, you got nothing.
You got nothing. So it's a very... and so I've got two hats, in a way, on my head. I've got the hat of the creative chef who just wanted the best produce on the plate and want to be generous and want to give, because deep down, that's what I cook for. Mm. The pleasure of giving great food and great produce, talking to my grower. You know, the other day, I've got this grower in the Blue Mountain who turned up with 5 radish. And I said to me, how much is that? And he said, $15. I said, you can't do that. You can't drive from the Blue Mountain to deliver me 5 radish. You took 3 hours to come down, the petrol and all of that, for 5 radish. They're the best radish I ever found. But, you know, but if I don't say to him, change your business model, because you know what? In 3 months, I'm not going to be able to get this radish because this guy will be bust.
Mm.
You know, so we need... That's my exciting part, of saying, yeah, it's great, give. But also, we live in a society in Australia when it's a very high cost of living. Last weekend, to have my restaurant open, we were paying $52 a waiter per week holiday.
You serious?
Yeah. So what do we do? Should I add this increase in wages into the price of the restaurant? That's what everybody does. We are the slowest of everything, because celebrity chef are the leader in my industry, and they think they're unstoppable and all of that. But we don't have one union who stick together. You know, the biggest problem we've done in my industry is when the GST happened. I'm not saying I'm against or for, but we should increase the price by 11%.
Hmm.
What we did, restaurateur, we just say, oh, that's fine. Let's put the GST on top.
Including the bill.
That was the biggest mistake we've done.
So they just lost 11% of profit.
We went 11% backwards in one day.
Wow. Yeah.
When there is a tax beer, when you buy beer, every 6 months, forced or whatever, they write it to you. Mm. They pass it on to the customer.
And you don't do holiday surcharge? You didn't do the holiday surcharge?
No, we didn't. Yeah. We didn't. So it's... You know, and also we've got so many restaurants. Just think, pre-Olympics
in Australia.
It's important. I love Australia, but let's think about Melbourne and Sydney, who are really the two big engine room of Australia in the hospitality game. Think about pre-2000 Olympics. Okay, Look what we've got now. The number of restaurants. Are we talking 100 more restaurants in Sydney?
I just take it all for granted, but in a relative sense, do you think we have too many restaurants in Sydney relative to, say, Paris or, like, per capita?
I think we don't have enough people.
Okay,
we don't have enough people. Also, we are in a country when people don't go out on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Sure.
You know, so every restaurant is full Friday, Saturday. But you can't have a successful business if you only open two nights.
So it's sure. Are you saying then, Guillaume, that there are, as a landlord, I've experienced this, there are too many people who think that they can just go, I'm a chef, or I know how to cook a little bit, I can go and open up a restaurant, and they just assume that they're going to make money out of it.
Yeah, and also they think it's fine, but also there's a lot of investors who think, well, that's cool, I want to have a restaurant.
Yeah.
But I think this time is running down because they realize then there's no much left at the end. If you're really serious about what you're doing, okay?
Mm.
So meaning value for money. And value for money doesn't mean cheap, because if you pay for expensive produce, you expect to pay the right amount. Because if you don't pay the right amount, there's something wrong with the Wagyu beef, the lobster, the caviar, and all that. So I think what happened with the GFC has been a big cleanup of average restaurant who are not right. And I think the people of Australia and the tourists are starting to know who are the restaurants who are succeeding.
Restaurant Paddington is...
Paddington's doing well. You know, I worked last night to 11 o'clock. We were full on a Tuesday night.
Fantastic.
Of tourists and local. Paddington is my baby in a way of I wanted to create a very special occasion restaurant.
Sure.
Problem with a very special occasion restaurant, and that's the thing you learn as you go with my business anyway, is... whatever you want to do, at the end, you will do what the demand asks you to do.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. You can't tell the people. The people will tell you.
Well,
was it strategic in how you, like when you, just, when Bennelong closed down and you were thinking, okay, you're going to do another restaurant, I can go similar to Guillaume at Bennelong, or I can go, you know, sort of bistro at Crown.
Nick, I did exactly the same. So I thought, okay, I don't want Bennelong anymore. I'm not tendering, okay? So people say, how do you feel about losing Bennelong? I say, well, I haven't lost because there was a lease.
Yeah.
When there is a lease, there's a starting time and a closing time, okay? So you always know when that's going to finish, okay?
I think many people know that. Good to set the record straight. A lot of people say that to me too. They go,
lost. And when the lease come up, they wanted to change their vision.
Mm.
When I presented my vision 14 years ago to the board of the Opera House, who was... a different board, different chairman, and they endorsed my vision, and we went on it. Was that a successful business? It was a very hard business. It was really hard, very demanding, got a lot of hours, a lot of Saturday morning sport I miss with my kids, and, you know, will I do it again? I'm not sure, but I made a lot of people happy. We raised a lot of money for charity. We made so many weddings. We, you know, when I say I was not tendering, and I have this discussion with Kim Williams, who was a chairman at the time. I sent him my press release before he was going public to let him know that I was not going to tender. So it was done the perfect way. And after that, you know, so I got heaps of letters of people saying, oh, that's the same. But the thing who marked me the most is the people from Wagga Wagga, from middle of New South Wales, Queensland, said, we used to come here once a year for a special occasion, and you made us happy as a family. And, you know, they're the letter I keep very close to me.
But that's success.
Yeah, it's great, you know. And after that, I say, where do I go? And I was obsessed at finding a venue like the Opera House. It's not such a thing, okay? So I say, okay, what do I want? And I went overseas, and I went in London. I went to a restaurant called the Leadbury in Notting Hill, was run actually by an Australian chef called Brett Graham. It's a two-star Michelin restaurant, amazing. And Notting Hill, very much like Paddington houses. And and I look at Darcy's. Firstly, Darcy's for me has got a very soft spot in my heart. This is a restaurant I took my wife when we have a first daughter, when she have one night out of the hospital, we went to Darcy's. When I left Key, I went to approach Attilio, the owner of Darcy's, and tried to buy it, and he said to me he wasn't ready to sell. So I got Bennelong. So it's just, it's funny, life is just a trail, you know, and you keep coming back to, and I said, this is what I want to do. Is that a very successful restaurant? We're full, but we decide to go top end of the market. So we are classic French technique with an avant-garde who's very much Sydney. We will be, but we opened a year and a half ago, so it'd be very easy to throw the towel and say, you know what, much more easy to run a bistro.
Sure.
I've got 30 staff at Guillaume, and we do 55, 60 people.
That's a good ratio, isn't it? Well, service.
It's a good ratio if you're a customer.
Yeah, if you're a customer, yeah.
But you know what? It is my flagship, and I really enjoy being there, and I keep pushing the boundary, and I think we're creating something very special. Mm. On the other hand, I've got Bistro Guillaume, who's going to open in the city on George Street, and that's a very commercial agreement. That's going to be my bistro.
When's so that happening, Guillaume?
July, August.
Where is it?
The Suncorp building, so next to NAB House, 259 right. George Street.
Okay, that's not far from us.
In a lobby, and it's going to be breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Perfect.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, takeaway.
Are you taking on Rockpool? Is it sort of like
no,
a...
No, I'm taking
on... Because he's just up the road. He's got his hamburger joint
Neil
down,
is
right?
my friend.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
And we, the CBD of Sydney,
yeah.
I think it's 30,000 people who need to be fed.
Absolutely.
You know, we need... There's not enough restaurant in the CBD.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're opening. I didn't realise you're opening it because my building is... Where my office is and where Nick is, we're just above Rockpool, and I use his bar as basically my canteen. I go there every second day, that Neil Perry's bar.
Yeah.
And only because it's quick, fast, simple, and I know what I'm going to get every time. It's consistent.
Yeah.
Either got fish salad, steak salad, whatever.
And that's what we're going to do.
I'll be able to walk down the road and see you,
perfect,
Neil.
Perfect, perfect.
No, I'm serious. I need somewhere else to go. I don't know where else to go in the city unless I've got to go to Zoom or something.
And I'm amazed the number of people, business people, who eat every day for lunch. There's still a lot of people who do that.
Yeah.
So I've got that. I just took over the four in hand.
Yeah, that's right. I heard about that. Yeah,
so we open on Thursday. So
In the restaurant?
Yeah, the restaurant and the pub.
Okay,
so I'm
cool.
doing all the bar food.
Because I've seen you putting it up on Instagram.
Yeah. So
but that wasn't you then, was it?
That was your food. So we started, yeah.
Okay.
And I'm doing a gastro pub. So my version of what gastro pub, I think, is in... Yeah, my version of the Sydney food.
What's a gastropub mean?
Well, that's England. That's comfy food. That's
it's like a Heston Blumenthal style stuff.
Comfy
food.
Comfy food. Yeah. So I'm thinking about gastronomy.
Not tricky food.
Yeah. Comfy food.
And
you mean like mashed potato?
Mashed potato.
Steak or something.
Very simple. And it was very important for me if I do that to make sure it doesn't interfere with the bistro.
So yeah.
This is not a French bistro. It's a gastro pub.
Because the Four in Hand used to have that
Colin.
Irish guy.
Yeah,
was,
Colin. Yeah,
it was good. It was great. But it was a bit fancy. Like, not a bit fancy, but a little
Lots
bit fancy
of
for
pork
pub.
And,
yeah.
But he's done two hats. He did a great job.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not looking for a hat here.
Yeah.
I'm looking for a community restaurant
when
the local goes two times a week.
So that's a good point because, you know, like, well, you know, down in Waddo Bay, there's if you're trying to find a... somewhere to go and get a feed.
It's impossible.
I mean, sometimes I might go to that place there that Dunbar House for lunch or something like that. But it's okay. It's good. Like, it's a good venue and all that. But you know, if you live in Paddington, which is a very dense area, there is very few places you can go to.
Yeah.
So that'll do well.
And you need to have the right price structure so people go there and don't feel, you know, can spend $75 and have two courses and a half bottle of wine to
share.
What
are you going to call Bistro Guillaume?
We call it Four in Hand by Guillaume.
Four in Hand. So you've got, and just, what do you got down in Crown, both in
so
Perth and
I've got, I've got Melbourne, I've got Bistro Guillaume in Melbourne, Bistro Guillaume in Perth, and I'm a director of culinary for Crown, so I'm a director of the food and beverage
for everything
of Crown Resort.
Right.
We can stop at any point if you're uncomfortable talking about this. But it, like, what about the structure of like of the deal you've got with Crown versus? So you own these. Well, you may or may not own Four in Hand. I'm not sure, but you own the one at Paddington.
Yep.
You own a couple of other places. Is it better to sort of come in there as like a culinary director, or is it better to as a business? Is it more less stress? Like, can you do what you need to do as a director?
I think there's as much capex you want to put out.
Yeah, sure.
And I think the reward I'm getting of 33 years of of who I am in my professional life,
yeah,
make people wanting you to open,
sure,
a place in their
that is your CapEx business. 33
that's,
years.
Well, that's right.
And they're getting that
that's
from
right.
you. And
that's
they're going to pay for it.
And so at Melbourne and Perth, you know, I've got a management fee with
yeah.
Grant,
yep.
and we're partners, and it's been going well.
But you direct traffic, so you say this is the menu.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to bring some real vision.
Sure.
Of keeping in mind, Cran is a beast.
Yeah.
And just sending a little bit of love with the staff, and just saying, you know, when you do a room service every night from midnight to 7 a.m., mm-hmm. You don't see much of the light, and I'm talking not just the light from outside.
Yeah, yeah. So the room services is like you.
So
actually,
I'm doing the menu. I've got a menu in Cran, Melbourne, and I'm doing the menu in Perth.
Okay.
I'm doing all the Cran room service in Perth.
Is it easier to like to run it from that sort of perspective? Because like I imagine for Crown, it's not so important whether or not the restaurants run at a profit. It's more there to feed the.
No, these days,
no, it is.
I think they have to, because it's square meters of
real estate,
sure. and they need to get a return.
Sure.
So obviously they've got other income.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's a business and it needs to be successful.
Okay.
It's got to stand on its own, right? And I get that. So in other words, there's no loss leaders anymore.
No,
you know,
no.
You can't. Yeah, I mean, we've got to try and get as profitable if possible. Sometimes it might be a loss leader. You know, I mean, you just said to me, you've got Crown Perth, Crown Melbourne, Bistro Guillaume
yeah.
coming up in George Street.
Four in hand.
And also, I'm a culinary advisor to Public House Group Management, so the people who bought all the pubs, and I'm helping them, advising them on the Woollahra Hotel, so Bistro Moncur,
yep.
the Colleroy Hotel, the Buena Vista, and the Forbes Hotel.
And of course, you've got your own restaurant, Paddington.
Yeah,
Guillaume's.
Yeah. You've got the TV shows. You've got the publishing books.
I often see you with Maeve Amira, which is one of my favourite segments when I see my mate up there with Maeve. Maeve's fantastic. I mean,
amazing. That was one of the things I've done.
You went around the world with it. You went to France.
Yeah. 10 days. We filmed 10 hours of TV in 10 days.
That's a lot.
That was 6 a.m. to midnight, and after that, we were driving the van to go to the next place. It was unbelievable. I didn't really want to do it. You know, financial was like, oh. And I come back. I was so rejuvenated. I was so proud of what I do. Because I connected with the people who make me sure. what I am. So the baker, so we spent a day.
I saw that episode. You took me into the baker.
You know, the guy, every day the guy get up to make the best bread he can.
Yeah.
We went to a ship. Some people making this amazing organic goat cheese in the middle of nowhere. And seeing the excitement in their eyes, I'm like, my God. And that's why I believe that's why France is so special, you know, the artisan, the craftsman.
How important is it to promote yourself for the, because you've got like this very serious, you know, chef side to you and businessman side to you,
yeah.
but then you sort of got to lighten it up when you get on TV and create like a bit of a persona and create PR for all these things. How important is it to sort of maintain that for the success of the other parts of your business?
I think, you know, there's different, I think you, doesn't matter if you do reality TV
yeah.
or a documentary, you just have, you know, I show my passion, sure. you know, like, and don't judge when you do a reality TV. Don't, you know, like you have to realize who's done the dish and what their capability. And if somebody, you know, and after that, you have to judge the technique of it, but also the passion and, you know, I think be kind.
It's got to be nice. It's not,
be nice. You know what I mean?
Nice.
Like you don't have.
Yeah.
It doesn't bring you anywhere. You know, and I understand for reality TV, there'd be an asshole chef, there'd be a table, there'd be the nice guy. But at the end of the day, you need to stand alone and
be encouraging.
Be encouraging. Like these people are making you famous in a way, not them, you know, not you, know what I mean?
So
let's don't forget you need them.
And I guess with all this, you've just given us a plethora of things that you do. Like it's a huge amount of gravity in what you do, and there's a lot of it as well. It's not just the weight of it, but there's a lot of things happening. How do you find time to be Guillaume Brahimi, just the guy? Or is that, does that define you? Are those
Mark,
things define
Mark,
you?
The the hardest thing for me is to find the balance.
Mm.
And that's unbelievable, because you know, there's a cliche of saying, you know, when you're happy at work, you might be difficult in your personal life or
vice versa. Tell me about it.
Vice versa.
I know. Well, ask my son. He's standing there right there.
So my...
This is our quality time.
Think of my quality time. Yeah, yeah. So you'll be able to do this with Loic one day. That's your son. He spends quality time across the table.
Yeah. So, and the problem is I can be very selfish. Not with me, but with my family, in a way, when I'm happy at work and the restaurant's busy. I can work 7-14 days straight. It doesn't bother me. Like when I'm in a mood.
But it bothers everybody else.
That's right. In machine, but you don't see it.
Can you do both? Is it possible? I mean, well, I don't think it's possible. My view is you can't do all those things you're doing in your business, my business, whatever, and do the other job very, very well.
Well, do you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a very successful restaurateur in New York, and I was saying, how do you manage all of that? And he said to me, I do my diary, and I do 25% family. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that's what he does, and he sticks to it.
Fills the diary up for the week.
For the year.
for the year.
So 25% family, 25%... friends, 25% business, and 25% himself.
It's pretty low weighting to business, isn't it? 25% business.
I don't think it's enough.
Yeah.
Business. For me, I know, but
I said to myself, well, my business is 90, so 95.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it's all...
But you got it. He's done a conscious thing. That's a very conscious thing. I couldn't operate my life where I have to walk around.
It's a very Buddhist.
I can't do that.
And he's very... Yeah.
It takes the passion out. Like, you're a Frenchman. Like, you can't sort of sit with a book driving the quarters.
But I'm trying to get better. Like, and the way I'm doing that is if I'm with my children, I am with my children. If I decide to take time with them, doesn't matter what's happened at work, I can't be on my phone checking who's at the restaurant. That's it. You decide to do tonight, not be at work, be with your children, it's okay.
Do you mind if I ask you, sometimes people don't want to talk about this, but you know, I've got four kids, but I know your kids, but you just, to those who are listening, tell us about your kids. I mean, what do you got, boy, you got Loic, your youngest son?
So Loic is four.
He's four now. I saw a photograph of him standing in your Mercedes through the roof yesterday.
Audi.
Audi, was it? Sorry, Audi.
Audi going to take the car.
Ambassador for Audi or something.
Yeah.
But I saw him, it was in the beach.
He's grown so much. Yeah, he's beautiful. He's just unbelievable.
And your beautiful daughters, I've got Violet,
Violet who's nine. Ono is 13 and Constance just turned 16.
What? Constance 16?
And we have a party for her on Friday. Oh, yeah, 100 kids at home. So
16?
Yeah.
Do you remember the girls when you just come at the 40 Nick?
I think I might have seen them once or twice out there. Yeah.
You would have saw the two older ones going back a few years ago.
But you look, I'm just saying that because you look so young, Gail. I mean, 16.
I've got probably some gene like your dad. So yeah.
His grandfather died. Grandma, 98.
Yeah, 98.
I can't boast that.
Usually the Italians that live longest, not the French people with the butter and the diet. Yeah.
I think, you know, it's amazing, you know, like I'm 48 and I've got four kids and that's, I don't need anything else right now. I just want, you know, work is good, but you know, my children are everything.
Yeah, you know.
Speaking about young people, like you've obviously got some young chefs in there, right, that are probably quite focused on being the best chefs they can be, but do you have any young guys in there that are sort of like, they want to be the business as well? They're quite interested in the business side of things, and they're coming up to you and asking you, hey, you know, look, I want to be a great chef, but I also want to...
I want to be in the business of being a great chef.
I want to build a great business too.
Not many. I think... So you've got... Firstly, not many people want to be a chef, okay? Who wants to work on the weekend and at night?
Is that true?
They all like the idea of it when they see Master Chef.
Yeah.
But when the guys say, you're starting at 8:30 and you finish at 11 tonight. They're long hours.
And intense too.
Intense and pressure. And so I said to them when they start, I say, well, if you stick with it, you're already 50% more than everybody else, because 50% will quit. So if you hold on.
Just last man standing.
If you're courageous and you're not scared of putting the hours, you are so well ahead of any 20 years old, okay? After that, just make sure you listen. And sometimes things don't make sense straight away, but in the future they will. It's an, you know, being a chef, you're making an investment for your future. So the hard yards you are doing, if you stick with it, don't try to do 20 restaurants in 5 years to have a CV like that, you know. I think just stick with one or two mentor and don't be shy to spend some time.
What about around town? Are you noticing like young people opening places up, you know, whether it's a restaurant or a bar? What are you seeing out there that you think is a good idea? And what are the things that you think are a bad idea?
Well,
when you see people open up for the first couple of months?
What's a good idea is there's a lot of entrepreneurial young kids up there, so I think that's great.
Yeah.
Do they have a good business plans? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The problem is...
Do you ever walk past something and go, oh, that's not going to work? I think that's a bad idea.
Firstly, me, I never want to see a restaurant going out of business. Yeah. I can't imagine the pain of somebody having financial distress.
Yeah.
And for me, when restaurants are full, every restaurant is full, and it's great. It means the economy is healthy, people are spending.
Sure.
But the thing is, with a restaurant, and I think it's more or less the same for every business, it's not one day. It's being consistent every day, every day, every day. So when you firstly, opening a restaurant at 20, it's a big risk, you know, like means a guy started at 18. In 2 years, you're ready to be a restaurateur. I'm 48 and I'm still learning, you know, so one step at a time, you know. I think go travel, you know. If I would recommend to a young guy, work in Sydney for 4 years. After that, have a good mentor who can send you to a great place in Europe or the States for 2-3 years.
Sure.
Come back, work again, share your knowledge than most of the Australian people wouldn't have. Mm. And when you're ready, be ready. You know, like a big difference being a chef than being a restaurateur.
Yeah.
The restaurateur pay the bills.
Yeah, sure. Are they mutually exclusive? Do you need to be a chef to be a good restaurateur?
No, you can be a front of house and be a restaurateur.
Yeah.
My position now, people might say, why you keep opening places? It's because I've got an abundance of great talent who have been with me for 8, 10, 12. You know, when we opened Paddington, and you might know that, Mark, but I'm a pretty crazy sport addict. And in a test match in rugby, they say, the Wallaby are 200 cap as a team, you know, so the number of test match each player play put together. Me, I was saying, how many with my team, I was saying how many cap we have. And when we balance it was an average of 8 years with me out of 30 people.
Well, you actually kept a lot of them after Benelong. You kept a lot of them on the payroll.
Yeah, that was
before you even opened up.
Such a great idea.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, that's part of what you stand for.
But that was an investment because, you know what? I trained. That was my DNA in a way.
And you invested in these guys.
But I keep, so I wouldn't be where I am now without them. So you have sometimes things don't make really sense on a piece of paper with numbers, but it is important.
Over time, especially.
Over time, okay?
Well, I want to make an observation about Gilman because, you know, Nick Hughes asked an important question and, you know, Gilman might not want to say that about himself. He might not even know this about himself, but one of the things I know about the guy, no matter what he does, this is Guillaume Brahimi, no matter what Guillaume does, he does it 1,000,000%. So there's no half. Even, like, I know when he trains, he's a mad trainer. And he trains, I would say, in some respects, to excess. Because he's excessive, because he takes the view, I think, I don't know whether it's a conscious view or not, but he takes it, if I'm going to do this, I've got to do this properly, I'm going to do it well, and therefore I'd rather go overboard than go under.
Mm.
You do this with your business.
Yeah,
you are excessive and obsessed with doing a good job, whether it's training. I'm sure it's the same with your kids, and I'm sure that's how it is with your business. With your, you know, you spend the hours.
And that's, you know, I don't think, and I'm not saying that's right or it's a balance. You know, we come back to the word balance. But, you know, I remember when I was at Benelong, I only have Sunday off.
Mm.
And from the moment I was finishing work on Saturday night at 2 a.m. after a 90-hour week, I was planning my Sunday. I wanted to do everything I could on a Sunday. Play with the kids, exercise, see my wife, do something, you know. And it's a race. And you arrive on Sunday night and you're like, I couldn't do that. And it was so not beneficial for my own health because I was just, you know, I was exhausted and all I should have done is rest and play with the kid, but I was trying to do everything. I'm talking about having a lunch, a glass of wine with my friend, play with the kids, go for a swim, go for a paddle. And it's just not possible.
Yeah, you can only put so much in.
That's right, that's right. You know, like, it's all about, like I say, I can do 2 weeks full on, no break, nothing. And after that, I do 2-3 days when I concentrate with the kids and I go back to this. I'm just, it's a continuous
rebalancing.
Challenge. And when you think you are, you're too much on the scale. And it's like with training. I'm obsessed with, because if I don't go to the gym, I'm so upset on me. So my normal day, you know, like today, took the kids to school. So 7 a.m., breakfast, kids to school, we're doing this thing. After that, I've got meetings for George Street. I will try to go to the gym in the afternoon. I must go to the gym in the afternoon because if I don't, that set me up for a very bad night in the kitchen because I was not organized. I couldn't go. And you know, people say, oh, just leave a little bit early and all of that. And that's so right. You know, like never rush to an appointment. Always make sure you're 10 minutes on time so you don't rush. It's all about, you know,
makes your life better. Planning.
Better.
Yeah, but planning, you know, it's funny. You know? Like I'm only just starting to learn this, but I tend to go like you hard for 14 days, 10 days, 12 days, but then I sort of collapse. I have to have 3-4 days, and everything sort of goes haywire, and I'm sort of just not available. I mean, I'm mentally conscious. I'm not available. I sort of have to go into a. So I'm like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. I'll be work Friday and I'll be work on Monday and I'll be available, but I'm just not mentally there because I don't think you can do this. I mean, as you get older, especially when you're 30, you can do it. Yeah. As I've got older, just become more efficient during the 10-day period at doing everything. And then, but I do need those 4 days off after the 10 or 14-day period just to recover a little bit and get my head back. And that might mean talking to my kids. In my case, it might mean me going to my farm, just hanging out at the gym, talking to you or Cocky or Dub or Ginge or whatever. Like it's sort of, but I need that time off. And I think this balancing, it doesn't matter whether you balance once a year, once a fortnight, once a day, once every 2 weeks. It doesn't really matter as long as you understand you've got to get a balanced rhythm going, a rhythm of balance.
Absolutely.
And then you've got yours. And my was up to more recent was haphazard. We in different times. But you must get that period where you just give up and just let your body have a rest and your brain.
And also being very efficient at work, you know, don't go to work and say I'm at work and not being efficient. So maybe spend a little bit less time at work, but when you're at work, you're very well organized and boom, boom, boom. Mm. You know, like I can imagine myself going at work and looking at the internet and watching the news and after do a little bit of things, you know, I go to work and cook. I want it to be full.
Yeah.
Oh, and, you know, I'm saying that was a very productive day. We need to be productive because if you're very productive, you will end up spending less time at work.
And your business is one of those businesses you can't do on the internet. Your business you can't do by email, remotely. No. You have to be there.
Yeah, but that's also, I need to trust my team. I've got a great team. I just employ a GM because I need a GM, you know, like a, you know, as of 5 weeks ago, I was still checking all the wages of the restaurants. You know, like you just can't do that.
Yeah.
You know,
that'll take way too much time.
Well,
yeah.
You can, and that's me being a control freak. And
I want to ask you about how important is being a control freak, do you think?
Well, I think it's there's a big difference of being a control freak. And if you're not, doesn't mean you become lazy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't check everything means I don't care. No. Don't check everything because now I've got a team who's getting paid to do that job.
And you have to rely on them.
And you have to rely on them. And if they don't perform, there is some KPI, they all over, and they're the one who get the blame.
Up until 5 weeks ago, I would not let anybody take annual leave or a sick day or whatever unless I approved it for my whole organisation. Up until 5-6 weeks ago. I've only just recently delegated it and now I just have the top tier guys who I look at. That's a form of paranoia. And a form of being a control freak in the business, but it took me some time to actually make myself let go. But I need to know who's on holidays, who's not on holidays, who's taking the piss in terms of taking sick leave, and you know, I just It's a paranoia, though. It's a bad paranoia.
Yeah, but you look at the most successful company, international company worldwide. There is no structure like that. You know, like you look at Google.
Mm.
It's. I was lucky enough. A friend of mine worked there, and I visited them in a state. It's nothing like a company, you know.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
And it's all about like you responsible. You're responsible for what you do,
yep.
and you don't have to do it between 9 to 5.
Yeah, no, actually, that's a better way of doing things.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you do it, okay? It's okay. If you have to take the kids to school in the morning, that's right. You can start at 10, no problem.
It's based on sort of deliverables as opposed time.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't work in your place because
the
customer arrives at 6 p.m.
But it also, you can bring your problem at work. You know, I'm very be careful if I'm cranky about something. I don't arrive at work and being upset about it, so I'm going to upset the whole team.
Is that acting, though? Are you acting or are you performing?
Well,
or
a little bit of both.
A little bit of both,
you know. So I'm really be careful of, I know how much I'm going to set up the day at work, the way I walk into work. And if I go check the hand of everyone, hello, everyone, or if I just walk out and don't say hello to anyone, the guy say, oh, the chef is in bad mood. You know, so I'm very conscious now. Then whatever I do when I arrive in one of my restaurants, the first impression I'm going to give is a good one. And I can really feel at the end of the day.
Yeah, because it ripples, right?
I've got to learn to do that. Yeah. I might not take that way. No, seriously, because I'm a cranky bastard at work.
It's so easy. You're on the phone, you know, you've got worry, you've got... pays to go and you have to pay and you're like and you're working and you got guys in the kitchen, they're there for you, you know, they're cooking, they just separate that, you know. And I always make sure when I'm at the office looking at balance sheet and P&L, from the moment I go from looking at that to the kitchen, I can't bring that problem to the kitchen because that's
I actually remember,
they're unrelated.
I actually remember at my last job when the market was really crap and, you know, things were out of the boss's control, but he gave a speech at the end of the year that was the most depressing speech, you know, like it just really made the outlook look grim for him and everyone under him in the organization. And people walked away from that and they all felt like shit. You know, I mean, it's just so important for the leader to convey positivity and have the right attitude because, you know, if he can't have the person at the top doesn't have the right attitude.
Well, it doesn't. Yeah.
Pretty certain.
But I'll tell you something. Yeah. I've got my chef in Paddington who's been hiding in a way of just listening to me, not being creative. And the last 3-4 months, I'm letting him be more creative. And I believe the food we're doing now is the best food we've ever done.
Yeah.
Because he knows what I want. Mm. He's got my DNA. You know, he's been cooking with me for 10 years. But he's a very creative person, and he's 10 years younger than me, and all he does is read books, watch things on Instagram. So he's one of the hipster, you know, like he goes out, you know, and he's working in a classic restaurant. So he's bringing this avant-garde into the restaurant, you know. They're the sort of guy who said to me, oh, we should have a ceramic plate. I'm like, no, we have porcelain. And putting my food on ceramic plate changed my vision of looking at it. I'm saying, wow. So it's trusting the people.
Yeah.
Use the people for what you employ them for. If he's a head chef of your restaurant, let him have a go. Because my job, and I really believe on that, my job as the owner of a business is to hire the best people available around me. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I want the best chef. I want the best sommelier. I want the best waiter. I want the best pastry chef. It's only going to make my brand better. The day you start hiring people who are yes people, gone.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay, we can talk for hours. Three things. Anybody, budding restaurateur, budding hospitality person, what are three, just, I mean, it's probably 103 things, but just what are three things that you would advise them to have a good look at before they decide to go into this industry?
Well, are they ready to do the hours? No,
that's the first thing.
That's the first thing. I would say don't ever compromise on quality. Don't hide. Don't ever compromise on quality. It doesn't matter if you do a pumpkin soup or you roast a lobster. Don't ever compromise the respect of the produce. And treat your staff the way you would like to be treated, but also treat the customer the way you would like to be treated. And that's why all my staff, I encourage them to go for dinner at restaurant, because I want them to understand what it is to be a customer.
And in other words, make sure the experience is right.
Yeah, that's right.
And I want to thank you, by the way, and I haven't had a chance to thank you publicly, but for putting me and my dad and my sons in your book.
Yeah.
And but what's the name of the book? Is it Guillaume?
So Food for Family.
Food for Family.
Yeah.
So and I really appreciate it.
So I did that with Sancha, my wife, and the idea was we did the first one was Food for Friends.
Yeah.
And I did that with Sancha, and that was dedicated to my dear friend Chris O'Brien, the professor Chris O'Brien, who passed away from a brain tumor. And I wanted to give the money. I was a director of Lifehouse at RPA, and I said, well, I'm going to do that, because I think it was a very important thing. And looking at the book, I think about him, and it's a really good thing. And again, we got you know, some friends who with breast cancer, some passed away, and Sancha said, I want to do another book, and I want to give the money to the National Breast Cancer. And here we go. So we say, okay, we're not going to do Food for Friends, but what about we bring family we love, we go to their house and cook a roast lamb or fig tart, or just seeing the way, it's a little bit of a voyeur, because you go to somebody's house, and people who buy the book don't buy the book just for the recipe. They love looking what books are on the shelf, what candle they're using. And
it's fantastic.
And it's been fantastic. Anson Smart is probably one of the great photographers in Australia, and he did it. And the sales are going well, and hopefully we're going to give a big check to the National Breast Cancer.
That's fantastic. I mean, and I have to say, it was a great opportunity for me to see all my boys and my dad together at one place. And my mate Guillaume cooking, Greek lamb, and put on the spit.
We have such a good day.
It was fantastic.
And you know, like you will, you know, I love reading books, looking at pictures, and that's, you know, I don't find one bad image about this book, and so much memories, and the coffee table book, you know, I don't do a cooking book just to get a check, you know, I want it. They're special.
Yeah, it's a very pretty book, and I noticed actually I got put in front of me for the first time on the weekend.
I'll send you some.
But it might have been your wife that wrote this. It says the last son finally arrives.
Yeah, Nick was late.
You and I made you late though as well, because I forgot my keys. I left my keys back in my office and I had to get it anyway. So I apologize for that. It all worked out in the end.
The book come out.
Yeah.
So the book is a great. Yeah, very happy with it. It's you know, like my kids, we say, Dad, you don't have a book. Now we've got two, and we're very proud of it. And it's a nice thing. We sell them at the restaurant. People love it.
It's not a big deal, but I think anyone who's listening to this and wants to become a restaurateur, there's a full suite of things you need to do to be successful in this industry. And a lot of it is about doing something really for nothing. I mean, like doing the book, spending the time, getting the photography, producing the book, publishing it, and you know, these things. I mean, I noticed that Neil Perry, for example, has got some books on his counter there.
Yeah.
These are all part of the full suite of things you need to do to do well in your industry. Even in financial services, what I do, I write books too. But it's
coming here and doing the podcast. We don't get paid.
It's the same thing. Podcasts. I mean, this is all part of the full suite of things. It's not just putting your hat on as a chef, going to cook the meal, and think people are going to walk out.
There is a fine line of I could have only Guillaume in Paddington and just do that. Don't do anything else and cook there 5 days a week, and 2 days off. Life could be much simpler.
Like Aldo used to do. He played golf every golfman.
And you just do that.
Yeah.
But you know what? I've got a little bit of an entrepreneur in me, and I'm like, you know, it's really hard to say no when somebody offers you a good deal.
Yeah.
You know, and you, it's quite good for the ego to be in demand, you know, and all I did is, you know, for your family. Do you want to be successful for your family? And the problem is when you open a second restaurant, after that, two, three, or four, you got the recipe, so you just keep doing them.
And that's how you build your enterprise and your empire. Yeah. And, you know, the real successful guys in your industry out there are all doing the same thing. There's you, Neil, there's Matt.
Matt, yeah.
There's three I know, and they're all got a similar model.
Yeah.
A very similar model. And they all work their asses off. Everybody's working a million hours a week. And some of the businesses are probably flagship, and not that financially successful, but still flagship. And others are probably not flagship, but are much more successful in terms of the dollars. And put them all together, the mix is right.
Yeah.
Guillaume Brahimi, good mate of mine, great mate of my family's. Been a great pleasure having
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks,
Nick. This has been the Mark Boris Podcast. You can follow Mark on Twitter, @MarkBoris, and find out more at markboris.com.au.